The conventions are convening. Let's go right to Tampa and get started with Molly Ball, national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine, and the Takeaways Washington correspondent, Todd Zwillick. Hi, Molly. Hi, Todd. Where are you right now, Todd?
Hi, Brian. We are on Radio Row, Molly and I together, in the convention center that's connected to the convention venue by a tunnel. So we're right down inside the perimeter along the water in Tampa.
Just a short habit trail away from all the action.
Molly, I think we had a lot of white-knuckled flyers heading in over the weekend, afraid of being blown out of the air by all the overhyping of Tropical Storm Isaac, at least as it relates to Tampa. Was that the case on your plane?
My plane experienced some actual winds, which I don't think could have been caused by mere hype. We had a pretty bumpy ride and a pretty bumpy landing, but we did make it flying more or less directly into the storm last night.
Huh. Though based on the actual weather in Tampa, Todd, they didn't really have to cancel today, did they?
Well, in terms of weather, I suppose they probably didn't, although when we were up early for the takeaway this morning, the rain was driving and the winds were heavy. Anybody flying in pre-dawn or in those 7 a.m. flights this morning might have had a little bit of trouble. Did they have to cancel it strictly meteorologically? I don't know. Politically, certainly they did, and in terms of preparedness, I think with safety officials and the governor of Florida going around preparing residents for the worst, urging them to be prepared. With the storm still headed ashore in other places, it was the abundance of caution to cancel one day. And really, Brian, the first day of a convention, the number one day, are you really losing all of that much? The most important parts of these events are later and also in prime time, in the evenings between 9 and 11 p.m. And they haven't lost anything in that regard. Those schedules remain unchanged, and we can talk about that. But in terms of what they gave up, you know, not much.
Yeah, I have a mild conspiracy theory, Todd. Mild, but it's that since the major networks decided not to carry any convention speeches tonight, the RNC decided that they would bring a little more attention and more sympathetic attention on themselves by canceling today's proceedings than by having them. You think that's totally out to lunch?
Well, I think that any time these decisions are made, they are made with the media situation in mind. You know, they lost a day of the convention in 2008 in Minneapolis. Does anybody remember? Does anybody think John McCain lost because they lost a day of the convention in Minneapolis? I don't think so. And also keep in mind another factor. If they're looking for more coverage, if this storm should fall on New Orleans and cause havoc, which we all hope it doesn't, over the next couple of days, the RNC yesterday has they have declined to rule out extending this event to Friday. They haven't said they're going to do it. They don't have any plans to do it, but they haven't ruled it out. And if they feel that Mitt Romney or Marco Rubio or the primetime speakers of Thursday night, the nominee in particular, are getting overshadowed by weather events or they just don't want to be having a big party for a candidate opposite coverage of New Orleans getting battered by a storm, they can do it on Friday.
Right, and they should have that opportunity. And poor recovering New Orleans, if it turns out things get scary and bad with a potential Category 2 hurricane over there. But, Molly, this is a perfect example why conventions matter. We run on our air now on Sunday nights the Slate Political Gab Fest, and Hannah Rosen, I thought, said a great thing on it last night, which is that the only people who don't think conventions matter are political reporters. And we like to sniff at them because nobody actually gets nominated at conventions anymore. It's all a fait accompli because of the primaries. But America pays attention to pageants. We pay attention to the Olympic opening ceremonies and closing ceremonies with big ratings, not just the games, etc. And 30 million people are expected to watch Chris Christie tomorrow night. 50 million people are expected to watch Mitt Romney on Thursday night or whenever that speech actually does take place. So conventions really do matter. How do you feel about that?
I completely agree. I actually sometimes feel a little Pollyanna-ish for feeling that way because there is, like you say, this tendency to turn up our noses at this whole thing being just a big infomercial. But voters draw a lot of information from that infomercial. It is an unfiltered chance to see the candidates in the sort of purest self-presentation that they're doing. And that tells us a lot about what the message is that they think is going to be successful for them, how they want voters to see them, as they sort of, you know, turn the corner and go into the part of the campaign that people are actually going to pay attention to. I keep hearing from a lot of Republicans how important they think this is for Mitt Romney and also for Paul Ryan, because it's his chance to introduce himself really for the first time to the American people. But also for Mitt Romney, you know, he has struggled so much to define himself. And this really seems to a lot of people to be his one chance, a real make or break moment for him to come across in a sort of cohesive way, in a way that gives people a message about what he is and what he's selling. So it is an infomercial, but an infomercial can tell you something about the product on the shelf.
And Brian, it's
a one-at-a-time infomercial where Romney and then Obama get to do it by themselves, rather than in all the Republican primary debates where everybody, of course, was shooting at Mitt Romney as the presumed front runner, and then we'll have the three presidential debates in October, which might be even more important, probably will be even more important than the conventions. But this is his one-on-one speech to America. Todd?
Those are the two opportunities that candidates have to communicate in that unfiltered way, I think.
And I was just going to say, Brian, think about how rare opportunities for politicians are to reach the public unfiltered. They are so very rare. State of the Union addresses in prime time, debates and conventions. Election night maybe, but that's when the result is already decided. In politics, there and when the president addresses the nation, there are so very, very few chances to engage the public in prime time when they're on their couches at a time that they're paying attention, and this is one of them.
Other than in 30-second infomercials, I mean 30-second commercials, which usually go the attack the other guy route. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, day one of the Republican convention in Tampa. Our first guests are Molly Ball, covering the convention for The Atlantic magazine, and The Takeaways, Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Molly, I want to ask you something about something that happened before everyone hit the road for Tampa on Friday, but after our show, so we didn't get to talk about it Friday morning, Mitt Romney in Michigan made this birther joke.
I love being home in this place where Ann and I were raised, where both of us were born. Ann was born at Henry Ford Hospital. I was born at Harper Hospital. No one's ever asked to see my birth certificate. They know that this is the place that we were born and raised.
So, Molly Ball, you wrote about this for The Atlantic, saying the most troubling part of Romney bringing this up is not that he's trying to revive an actual debate about President Obama's legal status, but to reinforce the suggestion that there is a certain foreign haziness about Barack Obama in general. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think this is a theme that Romney has repeatedly alluded to. You know, he, in his one of his stump speeches, routinely talks about Obama not understanding America. And this sort of comes in the context of a discussion of capitalism and free enterprise. But at the same time, I think it's treading quite close to the line that some would argue his advisor, Governor Sununu, stepped over when he referred to Obama needing to learn how to be an American and then apologize for that. I think Romney did think he was making a joke, and I don't think he really is one of these conspiracy theorists like his friend Donald Trump, who really believes that Obama was born elsewhere. But by gesturing to that in a way that a lot of people didn't find very funny as a joke, he's tying himself to this angry and resentful and conspiracy-minded element of the Republican base that you would think it would be time for him to be trying to distance himself from as he tries to play to the middle for the general election, as he tries to get away from characters like Todd Akin and sell himself as a more reasonable figure rather than someone out there on the fringe.
Well, he may be playing to the middle, but he's also playing to his base and turn out as many people as he can who are completely skeptical of Barack Obama but maybe turned off to politics. And, you know, I was ready to dismiss this as a one-off and probably an ad-lib mistake on Romney's part. But, Todd, that was until right around the same time as the birther joke. I saw the press release announcing the official theme of the convention for Thursday night, the night that Romney himself speaks. Have you happened to see the phrase?
I have. It's Believe in America, isn't
it? It's We Believe in America. Now, that, to me, suggests that they're trying to communicate that the Democrats, that the president, who suggests this hazy foreignness, as Molly puts it, does not believe in America. Otherwise, why say it?
Right. That is certainly a viable interpretation, and I think John McCain's, I don't remember John McCain's convention slogan, but it was something very similar. I think a lot of this, Brian, represents the dilemma of the entire Romney campaign so far, and it's always the dilemma of any candidate who runs in a primary and then runs in the general. We've all heard it. Play to the base, then run to the middle. Play to the base, then run to the middle. That's not new. What's remarkable in Romney's case, and what's remarkable about, for instance, a birther joke at this stage in the campaign, is just how far to the right the Republican base seems to have gone. And the question for Mitt Romney always has been, looking back to even the midterm elections of 2010, even when it was apparent that Romney would probably be the nominee, is can he bridge that chasm? Sure, he can try to go to the right, and he had some difficulty doing that, convincing them that he was one of them, convincing them that his experience as governor of Massachusetts didn't make him a soft-pedaling liberal or a soft-pedaling moderate. They don't want to hear from a person like that anymore. If he has convinced the Republican base, the people who are at this convention, that yes, they can get behind him, is that at the expense of being able to reach anybody in the middle who's not only independent but undecided? How right. many of those people are there, and can you get from the right side of the chasm, can you bridge it back to the middle where elections are won? And even if it's a joke or a one-off comment like that from Mitt Romney, I think highlights the dilemma that he's had all along, trying to appeal to the same people who got a kick out of the Republican House agenda, out of the debt limit fight, out of abortion votes and repeal Obamacare repeatedly. And there's a big constituency for that. There certainly is. But getting back to the middle of the country, independent voters, women voters, it's a tough, tough stretch. This party is more conservative than it was even 4 years ago, and a lot more conservative than it was 8 years ago. And that's Romney's charge, and that's his mission. And it's not easy.
So we believe in America as a theme Thursday night. And here's an example of how Romney has already begun to use the term. He was interviewed on Fox News Sunday for yesterday's show and was asked what he will want people to take away from his Thursday night speech.
That I believe in America and in the American people. That I believe that this nation is unique and exceptional, and that we have everything we need to continue to lead the world in prosperity and in peace.
So not framed, Molly, as an accusation about Obama, but he raises the notion of American exceptionalism, which, you know, is code to people who speak that foreign policy language. Speaking of American exceptionalism, by the way, we have John Bolton as one of our guests from Tampa later in the show, a main proponent of that stance. But the official theme of the night out of his lips, I believe in America, and I can imagine the big signs that will be plastered around the hall that will say, we believe in America, and the implication will be clear. So the question arises, why do this, Molly? To Todd's point, how will this help Romney win the election? And one theory I heard over the weekend is that in terms of election demographics, he needs 61% of the white vote, and he's not there yet. Does that sound right to you?
Well, I would say a couple things about that. First, just to defend Romney a little bit, that Believe in America has been his slogan, the slogan of his campaign for more than a year now. And I think you raise an interesting point about the addition of we and the potential implication that's somewhat exclusionary there, that, you know, we believe in America and you don't. But nonetheless, this is a form of his existing slogan that he's been using for some time. It is an argument about American exceptionalism. It isn't this argument that he's been prosecuting, that that Obama apologizes for America and that Obama somehow doesn't have faith in the ability of the American people and free enterprise and entrepreneurialism, and thinks that, you know, we need government and a sort of European style overweening oppressive state instead of just the sort of can-do spirit of the American people. But, you know, I think to what Todd was talking about before and the voters that Romney needs to win, I think it's possible to overstate Romney's need to mend fences with his base at this point. Republicans are so motivated to defeat the president. In all of the polls, Republican enthusiasm is much higher than Democratic enthusiasm. I really don't think Romney needs to win those people over at this point. And that's why it's somewhat perplexing that he continues to sort of throw them this this red meat. And you see this tension in the Romney campaign between disappointment and anger. And they seem to not be able to decide whether the vibe they're going for is more tapping the public's anger at the state the country is in or at their disappointment with Obama. And this idea that you see in a lot of polls and focus groups that people aren't so much mad at the president as they are disappointed that he hasn't been able to bring all the change that he promised.
And this is Brian Molly is spot on. And this is just making me think of the choice of Paul Ryan. This is permeating so many aspects of the Romney campaign. The base of the Republican Party is behind Romney. There are no more fences to men. They seem to be so willing to get President Obama out of office that they'll be behind Romney. Great. Then the choice of Paul Ryan was a decidedly base choice. The conservatives love Paul Ryan. The Tea Party wants Paul Ryan. It's a risky choice because the Ryan budget is not popular with independents. In fact, it's decidedly unpopular. It's not that you can't win with that choice. I'm sure they could win if they do it correctly. But it was a choice that was decidedly towards the base, not towards the middle as a choice like Rob Portman may have been or other candidates may have been. It's true that the right of the Republican Party doesn't have an appetite for moderates right now. They're in a different place than moderates or gettable independents are, however many of those are left, especially those who are undecided. But that Paul Ryan choice plays to this dilemma that Molly's talking about, and I think it's permeating almost every aspect of this.
And, you know, there are about 8% undecided in the polls. People say there aren't any undecideds hardly, but if, you know, you look at the Obama vote and the Romney vote, it adds up to about 92%. 8% is not nothing. And I read a Wall Street Journal opinion piece, pro-Romney piece, that said the Republicans have more upside with swing voters than the Democrats do because centrist independents are pretty turned off to Obama. So the Republicans will stage more of a swing voter appeal convention and the Democrats more of a red meat base energizer. So we will see. You've laid out the dilemma as to whether they will actually do that and the reasons that they may or may not actually do that. We will see once it actually gets underway. We thank you for getting us underway. Molly Ball, national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine at the Republican convention, and Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent at the Republican convention. Thank you both very, very much. Great start.
Anytime, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we continue from Tampa in just a minute. Dean Scalos is the most powerful Republican in New York State. He just finished hosting a state delegation breakfast. We'll talk to him about, I don't know, maybe a fish out of water for some of these folks, the more moderate New York Republicans, in with all these evangelicals from the South and everybody. Dean Scalos, New York's most powerful Republican, coming up from Tampa next. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're very active, by the way, on both Twitter and Facebook during these two convention weeks. Follow me at Brian Lehrer on Twitter or like us at facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC. With me now from Tampa is New York's most powerful Republican, the State Senate Majority Leader Dean Scalos of Long Island. Thanks a lot for doing this, Senator Scalos. Nice to have you back on the program.
Good to be with you.
And you just hosted the New York State delegation breakfast, so I really appreciate your time coming right out of that. What was the most interesting piece of business or discussion you had at the breakfast?
Well, it's really the first time that the entire New York State delegation, delegates, alternates, guests, had the opportunity to get together to have breakfast, to listen to a couple of speeches, and really just to reacquaint ourselves with people from different parts of the state and to, you know, really excite the fact that we're going to elect Mitt Romney, our president, grow our congressional delegation in New York State, our Senate and Assembly delegation.
We saw in the New York Post today that the New York delegation is getting prime seating near the stage for the primetime speeches. And they say it's because New York has the most diverse delegation and they want that on camera. How diverse are you?
Well, we are very diverse, and we have people of all ethnic backgrounds. We have people of all shades of color, which I think is tremendous. And we are the melting pot of the country. We're also the financial capital. A lot of money raised in New York State, so we're front and center where we belong.
So Guam, Puerto Rico, and New York, according to the Post, get these spots so America sees as diverse a Republican Party as possible. What do you think of that bit of stagecraft from a national politics perspective?
For, New York State?
Yeah.
Well, New York State is obviously it's a challenging state for nationally, but we've done exceptionally well. Two years ago, we elected more congressional people, new congressional people, than any other state in the nation. We won back the Senate majority. We grew our assembly. And we have more county executives and county legislatures that are under Republican control than Democrats. So we're growing in New York State. Nationally, it's a challenge. But people come to New York State, raise money, and we're going to grow the party in New York State.
Why do you think there is so much split government at the local level around the state? We generally think of New York as a solidly blue state in terms of the presidential election, but it actually has a fair number of swing congressional districts. You mentioned the county executive count. The Republicans control the state Senate under you. What do you see as New York Republicanism, and what is the main theme of your statewide campaign to convince New Yorkers?
Number one, it's a functioning government. We saw the dysfunction that existed in Albany when the Democrats control every branch of government. Taxes went up by $14 billion, spending by $14 billion, losing jobs. And we've turned that around. We've two early budgets. We are working on a bipartisan basis with Governor Cuomo, getting things done. We're cutting taxes. We're cutting spending. And two early budgets. So people, it's resonating with people that Republicans know how to govern. We're focused on private sector job creation. We understand that taxes have to be cut, and we understand the hardworking middle class that they're challenged to live in New York State because of costs, and we're going to make it more affordable for them.
New York has, I think, what we could call a moderate Republican Party compared to many states at the convention. Do you feel like this is really your party all the way when you see these things like the constitutional ban on abortion in the party platform, or some of the other things that the national party has come to represent?
You know, there are things that you agree in a platform. There are things you don't agree with a platform. But one thing we all agree upon, Republicans throughout the country, is there's a lack of leadership with President Obama in Washington. Mitt Romney understands how to turn the economy around. He's been a job creator. That's what we need as president. He has been a job creator. He understands you have to cut taxes. And that's a Republican message. That's a Democrat independent message also. Ronald Reagan talked about cutting taxes and controlling government spending. And we have the Reagan Democrats out there that are waiting to come back to us, and we welcome them back.
New York State Senate Majority Leader Dean Skelos of Long Island, my guest on WNYC, the most powerful Republican in New York State. You know how New York State government works, right, folks? It's the State Senate Majority Leader, the Assembly Speaker, who's a Democrat, and the Governor, currently Andrew Cuomo, who makes so many decisions about what goes on for the state. And so one of those three men in the room is a Republican, and he's in Tampa at the Republican Convention, and he's with us on the phone right now, Dean Skelos. So one of Mitt Romney's proposals, Senator, is to end Medicaid as a federal-state partnership and to turn it entirely over to the states with a block grant that I've seen reported as less than the current federal share. Would that be good for New York State, in your opinion?
Well, I don't know how that would work out yet. You know, we certainly would look at it. But what we do understand is we have to control spending, whether it's in Medicaid. We can't make it impossible for future generations to be able to get Medicare and other types of health care benefits. In New York State, on a bipartisan basis with Governor Cuomo, we've controlled Medicaid spending without hurting people that truly need assistance. And the only person up to this point who is looking to take money out of the Medicare system for our seniors is President Obama, who's looking to take out over $700 billion. So we want to save the Medicare program and make sure health care is available for future generations.
Now, of course, the Democrats will disagree, and I don't want to get into this right now about what that $7 billion actually is, whether it's a cut or not. But my question was about Medicaid, and that is a federal-state partnership with respect to health care for the poor. And Romney wants to turn it entirely over to the states with a block grant that's less than the current federal share. So specifically, would that be good for New York State in your
opinion?
Again,
I would have to look at the numbers. We have a very generous Medicaid system in New York State that's grown almost to prohibitive levels. We're looking to save local governments and counties pay part of that, save money for them. So I would have to see the numbers on that type of change.
So you're a little skeptical on that one starting out, it sounds like.
Whether you call it skeptical or not, I just don't have enough information to make a decision on it yet.
And the similar proposal that they have for food stamps to turn it over to the state as a block grant?
Look, if it can be better policed in terms of avoiding fraud, avoid stealing, then I'm all for it.
With less money from the federal government to feed all the poor people who qualify for food stamps in New York? Again, you're not skeptical?
Well, you know, the problem we have in New York State and many other states is that entitlement programs are to really help you get back on your feet. And many of the entitlement programs that we have right now keep you within that program rather than, you know, getting you off. And that's why it's critically important that we continue to be focused on private sector job creation so that there are jobs available for those who are presently on entitlement programs. If somebody truly needs assistance, New York State will always be there, but it's getting to the point of being unaffordable.
Let me ask you about some news that's been breaking from up in New York. One of the most powerful Democrats in the Assembly, Vito Lopez, who is also the Democratic Party chairman of Brooklyn, was found by the Ethics Committee, as you know, to have committed sexual harassment. Governor Cuomo is calling for him to resign altogether. And Democratic State Senator Shirley Huntley of Queens accused, I guess, of misusing funds. Do you have a reaction to either of these cases?
Well, I think with Vito Lopez, I agree with the governor that he should resign. There has been some sort of a settlement that Speaker Silver has entered into in terms of his harassment of women. That's not acceptable. I think he should resign. Shirley Huntley, we'll see what the charges are today. And certainly, I guess there's a process that she will go through. But certainly, whether it's harassment in the workforce, sexual harassment, any type of public corruption should not be tolerated.
In Lopez's case, the Ethics Committee is a political body, not a court of law. There's no criminal proceeding or civil suit that I know of that any woman has filed. He's a 71-year-old guy with no apparent history of this. And Lopez has a lot of enemies in both parties. Should he resign or wait for a more non-political judgment of his guilt or innocence?
Well, first of all, his resignation should not be based on politics. It should be based upon his acts. And the Assembly Ethics Committee, which came out with the recommendations, was a bipartisan commission both four Republicans and four Democrats, and it's my understanding that their vote was unanimous.
State Senate Majority Leader Dean Skelos with us from the Republican Convention in Tampa. Skelos from Long Island. Another issue, a court ruled last week on a suit against the MTA, brought in part by the Nassau and Suffolk County executives, against the payroll tax in the MTA region that produces, the number I've seen is about 15% of the MTA funding. You were in on the deal with Governor Cuomo to lessen that tax recently. Are you for this lawsuit to abolish it?
Well, certainly I think the MTA tax is probably one of the most regressive anti-job taxes that were imposed by the Democrats, Governor Patterson, and the Senate and the Assembly. The Senate, when it was controlled by Democrats, every Republican voted against it. We understand it's a job killer, and we'll see how the court process plays out. But certainly, I've been against the MTA payroll tax. We were able, 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, to eliminate about 80% of the small businesses that had to pay the payroll tax, school districts, libraries. And now, based on the court decision, we should go all the way and eliminate the payroll tax completely.
And then what do you do? I mean, the payroll tax is on employers in the entire MTA service region, and yet it seems like the suburban counties are arguing that it's a transfer of wealth from the suburbs to the city. Is that an accurate argument, in your opinion?
The issue, Brian, again, it's a job killer. And if you create jobs, you have more people paying taxes. You have businesses paying, real estate transfer taxes, which is something that the MTA depends upon. You turn around your economy, the revenues will be there to make sure that the MTA can operate.
Can you depend on that? I mean, what happens to Long Island if this suit is upheld on appeal? I can just imagine the LIE if the LIRR is cut by 15%.
Well, my position is you don't have to cut the revenue. The state can step in. We've absorbed some of the costs in eliminating the tax on the school districts, libraries, and small businesses. Hopefully our economy continues to grow in the state where we can invest more money into mass transportation. But again, our focus should be on job creation. The payroll tax has been a job killer.
So is that a pledge, if this is upheld on appeal, until such time when the economy grows enough to replace this revenue for the MTA, that you would support an additional amount of state funding of the MTA to make up for whatever is lost from the payroll tax?
Yes, I would, and we'd have to see how those numbers work out. But you're also going to go through the legal challenges right now, so we're speculating that eventually the Court of Appeals is going to uphold that decision. What they're going to do is, who knows? So it's got a long way to go before we have to talk about replacement revenues. It's my understanding that this appeal process could take over a year.
All right. We've got just 2 or 3 minutes left with the most powerful Republican in New York State, Long Island State Senate Majority Leader Dean Skelos, joining us from the Republican Convention in Tampa. Just a couple of things real quick before you go. You and Governor Cuomo seem to have a groovy thing going. You've agreed to budgets and tax reforms, and you let gay marriage come to a vote and pass, and he let you have a redistricting plan that's favorable to keeping the Republican majority. Why is Albany, which used to be so dysfunctional, now more productive than Washington?
Well, number one, the governor has shown leadership, but he also, we've made a very conscious decision that we're going to listen to each other, try to get a result. Sometimes you can't get there. But we want to govern successfully, and we've been doing it. Republicans, Democrats working together to get results for the people of the state. Two early budgets, cutting taxes, two budgets in a row that have reduced spending from the prior year. So it's really about putting aside partisan differences and understanding that you're elected to govern. Governor Cuomo, to his credit, is doing that. We're doing it in the Senate. And Washington should learn from us. President Obama has become, the campaigner-in-chief, and really the president and the executive's job is to reach a consensus with the legislative branches. And we've been doing that very well in New York State for the last 2 years.
So whose speech, other than Governor Romney's, are you most looking forward to at the convention?
Could you repeat that again?
Yes. Whose speech, other than Mitt Romney's, are you looking forward to the most at the convention?
I'm looking forward to Chris Christie and certainly Paul Ryan.
Any New York Republicans getting to speak, even if not in prime time?
I'm not sure about that. I'm sure there'll be some congressional people that will be speaking. But it's about the vice president and nominee and certainly Mitt Romney to spell out their vision now about the future of this country. And certainly I think they'll have that vision, and people will elect Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan.
And last thing, we've got a series going where we're asking a lot of people from both parties about personal things in their lives that help to form their political views, series we call That's My Issue. Why are you where you are today, making a career in politics? Was there anything that happened to you or your family early on or along the way that directly affected you, that helped shape your political views?
My mom, she was a volunteer for Tom Dewey when he ran for president. She was involved.
He won, right? I read that in the Daily News.
Yeah. She was involved with that, and she instilled in myself and all of us. My brother is an appellate division judge in the second department. The fact that public service is honorable and doing what you can to make lives better for people is something that is a good thing to do. And she always encouraged me. She was there licking the envelopes, putting the stamps on. throughout my entire political career. So I know she's looking down and saying, good job, keep doing what you're doing.
By the way, it wasn't the Daily News, it was the Chicago Tribune that had the famous Dewey Wins headline. We hope all the media will get it right on the morning of November 7th this year, when hopefully we will know if either Romney or Obama has won. And we thank the New York State Senate Majority Leader Dean Skelos for giving us a good deal of time right after the delegation breakfast in Tampa. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll take a closer look at that sexual harassment case against one of the most powerful Democrats in Albany, who's also the Brooklyn Democratic Party chairman, Vito Lopez. And not just his story, but the implications for housing in Brooklyn and around the area. He's the housing committee chairman, and he brings home so much affordable housing bacon to New York. So we will look at this shocking, because it came out of nowhere, Vito Lopez case coming up next.